welcome to another edition of Old School Guns. This is edition number 49. So we're almost at 50. Almost. So, you know, here we are. And, you know, there's a lot of things have been happening. Hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving and look forward to a great holiday season. But there's still stuff out there happening. There's the impeachment debacle and a few of these other things go on. A couple of the more disconcerting things that have happened are, you know, two terror attacks in Europe, done with knives, so they can't blame guns this time. But it appears, you know, the jihadis are still out there. And even when a government, like the British government, gets one of these guys, convict them, they put them in jail, at some point they turn into a softie and let these guys out. And this one guy just stabbed a Cambridge student to death on a bridge in London. You know, it is despicable. It is disgusting. And, you know, when they get their hands on these people, they need to take action, not just store them for a couple of years and then turn them loose again. No, this guy, and, you know, I don't care about the citizenship and all the rest of it. This guy needed a one-way ticket back to Syria or wherever it was he originated from. You know, crimes, when he's trying to blow up, he was originally convicted for trying to blow up the English Stock Exchange, a British Stock Exchange, I guess. Well, that should have been right there. They should have revoked his, terrorism should be a way that your citizenship is revoked and you are sent back to wherever it is you came from after you've been incarcerated for however long they deem fit. Until they do that, these guys are still going to wander out loose. And I tell you what, you know, look over your shoulder when you're at malls and shopping this Christmas, because you just don't know what's out there. You just don't know. Okay, let's get to some interesting news here. It looks like the Kamala Harris candidacy and campaign is dead. I mean, it's had it. It's basically got its four legs up in the air. There's no way that this is going to happen. She's a terrible candidate. Because, frankly, she just isn't very smart. And I don't think she actually believes in anything. When she was a prosecutor, apparently she was a hardcore prosecutor. And then that should have, any analysis of that should have told her that a future in the Democratic Party is not going to go very far. You know, she lucked out and on some, I imagine, some wave of diversity, coolness, and everything else, she was able to cloak who she really was, and get elected to the Senate. But it's one thing to get over and get elected to the Senate in California as, you know, a multi-minority female, which is, I guess, how she portrays herself. And it's another thing to actually conduct a national campaign and touch and make a connection with voters in different parts of the country who may see past that and want to know what you think on issues and how you conduct yourself. And Harris didn't measure up. She's a fool, and her campaign is just completely going bust. And, you know, the big reveal in all this was, you know, obviously she treated her staff like garbage. And that's where she's really angered the Democratic establishment, because I'm sure she had a lot of establishment operatives in her campaign, because in many ways, she was an ideal candidate for them to go against Donald Trump when you just look at on the surface demographics of female, multi-ethnic minority from California, basically embracing their liberal checklist. You know, she would have been a much more appealing candidate on a national stage, but she just couldn't carry it off. She, in the end, all of those things could not cloak who she really was, which is a not very smart, overly ambitious politician. So I assume that within the next month, she's probably going to be toast. So goodbye and, you know, good riddance. And I hope she likes California, because she's never going to get out of there. She's never going to go higher than the Senate, if she even retains that. The next one, and I just can't let this go because this guy's so anti-gun, but it appears that Eric Swalwell, who I call Eric Sewagewell, is more true to his name than we all thought. It appears that when he was on NBC about, what was it, a week and a half ago or whatever, he appeared to rip one and Of course, they've all lied about it and tried to cover it up and say, oh, well, somebody was dragging a coffee cup across a desk. And I'm like, you know, I tried to read. I have a couple different types of tables with different types of tops on it. And there's no way that I could reproduce that sound by dragging anything across them. So I was thinking, you know, poor old Eric, you know, he had to drop out of the presidential race. He's kind of the loser frat boy. You know, so maybe we should buy him something for Christmas. And I thought, well, we could buy him a windbreaker. And then I realized, hey, he's already got one of those. He carries it between his back pockets. So he doesn't need a windbreaker. I don't know, maybe we can get him a DVD of the movie The Wind Talkers. Because definitely, you know, from him, no matter where it comes from, it's all wind. And it's all the same. And it all smells bad. So if that's not the case, I thought maybe get him one of those emergency vests, you know, in case he's ever out sailing or something else and winds up dunked in the water. You know, and they have a little, and we can even save money because we wouldn't need the CO2 cartridge that would inflate the thing because, frankly, my man's sewage well has got the gas covered. So he could self-inflate that and be safe. So if he's on your Christmas list, those are my suggestions that he could get, and he would probably enjoy those gifts very, very much. That or a, you know, maybe a whoopee cushion because, you know, you can't produce gas on demand, so maybe a whoopee cushion will keep him happy. Hey, one of the cool trends I see, which I really like, is, you know, with sanctuary cities and basically the people giving the federal government and ICE and all that, the big middle finger, we're not going to cooperate, we're a sanctuary. Now we have gun Second Amendment sanctuaries, and I don't think the liberals are going to like that. It's a very cool thing. I'm glad to see it. I do think it has some danger. It's another step in polarizing and dividing the country. It's another indicator that that's happening. It's not causing it. It's just an indicator that that's happening. But I'm glad to see it because, frankly, I like it when liberal logic and their stuff is used against them. And they don't like that at all. They can't stand that. And it's like red flag laws. We said in previous podcasts, when we started, generally the media in general, not me, but... You know, and they started pointing out that people like Chris Cuomo and some of these liberals that go berserk, and you can think of the Charlie Sheehans, and now it appears that Mark Hamill, he was in like the first Star Wars movie. Now he's like this goofed up old man, and he's doing some stuff. Whenever one of these guys, actually Peter Fonda was another one. He's deceased now, but he was talking some serious ugly stuff about, you know, Barron Trump. Yeah, that's really a great thing. Yeah, a 75-year-old man talking smack about a 9-year-old kid. Yeah, that's a real man for you. But anyway, when you point out those guys are red flag laws. That's what they're designed for. These people who've lost control of their faculties and are espousing this horrible violence and all the rest of it. Hey, all of a sudden people don't want to talk about red flag laws. It vanishes from the scene. Doesn't mean that they're completely going to be gone. I mean, there'll be some vestiges of them. And we hear a story occasionally how, you know, these seizures are being used. But they will be overturned in court because they obviously violate the Constitution. And eventually the judicial process will catch up with these things and they'll be gone. But until that time, it should make you feel good if you live in a Second Amendment sanctuary area that's not going to allow these things, not comply with them, not use them. I think that's a great idea. I would like to see Second Amendment sanctuaries in places like California that say, hey, F your assault weapons ban and all this other crap that you have. We're just not going to follow it. And, you know, turn the tables on them, see what happens. And if you're a rural county in California, rural, that's a good tongue twister. But if you're in one of those, maybe on the county level, you can get your sheriff and all that, and guess what? You know, no one is, they've got too much on their plate at the state level to come and care what Del Norte County or Siskiyou County or San Bernardino County are doing. They just got too much. So, hey, create a sanctuary. Even if it's only in your town, and even if it really doesn't have much teeth, pass the law, do it, and you know, get it started. So all of a sudden, they're hitting resistance everywhere. But I like seeing sanctuary areas, and I'm glad I live in one. Okay, let's look at some gear news and some content news. And we see that our friends at InRange TV are going to do, a couple of years ago, I think it was 2017, they did the What Would Stoner Do project, which is essentially making the lightest weight AR rifle they could, a semi-automatic AR rifle. And there is no real reason given for that other than, well, given given the fact that the original ARs were very lightweight and used the most advanced materials available in, you know, 1959, 1960 to produce the 5.56 version, earlier to produce the AR-10, the 7.62x51 NATO version. That if you look now, there's been so many more lightweight components, everything from titanium, firing pins, to all kinds of things, very lightweight barrels. Barrels that are now 14.5 inches with the permanently attached flash suppressor that makes them the legal length now, and all this, all these kind of other things that weren't available in 1959 or weren't thought of then. So how light could you make a serviceable AR rifle is what it amounted to. And with the things available in 2017, they came up with two rifles. At first, they were going to have a DMR and a kind of a short general purpose rifle. And they decided that the DMR didn't, the additional weight and bulk, even in the lightweight configuration of a DMR, just didn't have any advantage because they were able to shoot accurately and well with the shorter barrel version. So they basically scrapped the longer barrel version and went with the shorter barrel version. And turned out, you know, an interesting rifle. Nothing that has any real police or military applications. But they turned it out. The heart of the thing and where they made their most economy was using a polymer lower. And most of the polymer lowers on the market were just strict copies of the aluminum lower. And therefore, they could crunch and get weak and they weren't very good. They were junk. Everybody's tried it, failed. One company basically beefed it up and put the buttstock and the pistol grip as part of the integral molding to give it some strength and rigidity, and they used that. Those are no longer available, so now they have this boutique AR company that one of their compadres is either a spokesman for or runs or something. And it's the guy who shows up there, Sinistral Rifleman, kind of a pudgy dude who, yeah, looks a little kind of, you know, he doesn't impress me very much. A guy runs around in the body armor and all that, but has absolutely no military or police background, and uses the name tag Darth. I saw that in one of the videos, Darth, like, I suppose that's Darth Vader, but, you know, it's like, dude, grow up, you know, grow up. And so this guy has got, you know, either is part of a company that is manufacturing a slightly modified and improved version of that, of the polymer lower they used, and it still has the one piece stock. It's extendable with buttstock extensions you can put on the end, so you can kind of configure the length of pull, and it also has the ultimate gamer basically attribute on any rifle or pistol, which is the flared magazine well. The most important thing in the world you can have on your competition gun is a flared magazine well, because, you know, that tenth of a second of inserting a magazine, you know, you might be off just a degree or two, and this'll funnel it right in. So the flared magazine well's on there. What do I think of this? I think it's interesting. I mean, they tipped their hat when Carl said, well, you know, when you're, he used the term, when you're on the clock. Okay, whenever you hear that, you know it's a gamer gun. You just know that. And it has very limited application, or its advantages are not really all that useful outside of a gamer setting. So it's a gamer gun they're building. And there's probably a few more lightweight components out there now. And, you know, they cut some weight by doing away with any kind of iron sights, which is a horrible mistake. A really horrible mistake. But they do that, and just to keep it lighter, they go with the pencil, what we call the pencil weight barrels, which is the standard SP1 or AR M16A1 profile barrel. And again, they go with the short version, which is 14.5, the suppressor, that's flash suppressor that's on there. So, you know, they cut a little bit of weight there. They cut ounces here and there, and they can probably shave a pound off of, maybe off their previous attempt. But, you know, my deal is that I looked at the build sheet when they first did it in 2017. I guess it was like 2018. I looked at the build sheet. And to buy all that crud that they used, because everything was lightweight, everything was, you know, titanium and all the rest of this, the fact of the matter is it was like $1,800 to just get all the parts to build the gun. And really what you have is a gun with a polymer receiver and a parts kit that you've, you know, the fire control parts you put in yourself and all that. You know, frankly, unless you're just a top level, top, and I wouldn't even say top 1%, maybe top 1/10 of 1%, you're not going to notice the weight savings over, say, go buy yourself an Anderson lower, buy yourself a standard buttstock, or whatever buttstock you want. You can still go with an upper and either go with a pencil weight upper or, you know, do the 14.5 with the flash suppressor. Use the cheapy handguards, you know, the round standard M4 handguards, just like the military uses. And, you know, you can go from there. And I bet you will come out a little bit heavier. Use a standard bolt and all that. And, you know, you'll come out a little bit heavier, but you know what? For the cost savings you'll incur, you'll build that competitive aluminum receivered gun for probably less than a third of what this other one's going to cost. I bet this other one goes over $2,000. By the time they're said and done, I bet it goes over $2,000. And I bet you can build something that's not going to be the same weight, but for just a little bit heavier, you're going to build something for about $500. Because you have to assemble this yourself. Now, the interesting news is, and what they announced, and I haven't seen anything from Brownells, but they say Brownells are going to sell these. They're going to sell the lower, and I guess with all the parts in it and installed, and also complete guns. We'll see what all that costs. I assume that will be a very expensive undertaking. And I think you'd be a lot better off even buying one of their retro rifles and just going with that with iron sights. You'll probably have a much more durable and better package. But we'll see what they turn out. You know, again, it's interesting, but it is strictly a gamer type of a gun. It has no real application out of that for any reason. And, you know, that's what they know the best. So I actually kind of applaud them that they're up front. They're not saying, wow, this would be cool if you were for the Gambian Special Operations Forces or some other, you know, ridiculous, you know, type of use that they would get. This thing is not ever going to be that. And they know games. They play games. Their experience is rooted in games. And they play games. That's what they do. And that's what this is. This is a gamer tool. And it's not really anything that somebody who's serious about fighting rifles really is going to take all that seriously. He could look at it and say, huh, well, that's cool, but, you know, does it have any real relevance? And I would say that at this point it does not. That brings me to the next guy I kind of want to take a look at, and that is this James Reeves guy from the Firearms Blog, and there's Firearms Blog TV. I first saw this guy when he was actually on one of the in-range question and answers. They were down in New Orleans. They had the techie guy who contributed really nothing. They had Carsada, who, you know, is just Mr. Opinion. And then they had this Firearms Blog guy. And all three of them were drinking. And this guy Reeves would look to be drunk to me. So I don't even think I watched the entire thing. As a matter of fact, I'm sure I didn't. Because, you know, why watch drunks answer questions? And so I didn't check it out, but I wasn't very impressed. So I went over to his channel, and I've seen a couple of the things he's put up. Also, you know, they put his bio up there, so I looked at that. Again, no real experience, yet he's talking all this smack about battle rifle this and battle rifle that, and, you know, he doesn't even know what he's talking about. He's just regurgitating either things he's heard or things he's read, you know, when he's reading his comic books. And so when this guy's reading comic books and other people's legitimate work and experience, then he comes out and kind of parrots all this stuff. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, it's again, it's more kind of garbage content. And how can a guy without any experience really recommend something to you that you stake your life on? And even when it's somebody with the requisite experience, you know, you can't just take it on face value and say, well, this guy says it, therefore it's completely 100% true. No, it is not. No, it is not. You have to do the due diligence, because in the end, it's going to be your firearm. It's going to be you carrying it. It's going to be you using it. So you really have to apply yourself. You have to get in the game, and you can learn from some of these people with experience. But you also have to know when you're being BS'd, and there are some BS'ers out there, and this is one of them. This guy doesn't know anything about firearms. He doesn't like the Walther PPK because it has an aluminum frame, and it's heavy. You know, I mean, come on. I look at that, and I just kind of go, forget it. You know, you don't know what you're talking about. Goodbye. You know, just goodbye. And I, whenever that comes up on Google or something, I just kind of, you know, just glance over it. So that's the interesting part of that. One thing in the gun thing, I think it was Guns and Ammo. Is it Guns and Ammo? Somebody put out one of the, it's not Guns of the Old West, but it was, this was like a special. I think that's why it was the Guns and Ammo, you know, under their kind of banner. They do surplus weapons. Now they have done one of cowboy weapons. And, of course, there's someone is now making a conversion revolver built on, they take essentially an 1862 Navy, which is kind of a five or six shot. I guess it's a six shot. No, it is a five shot. The 1860 Navy was six shot. This one's five shot. But anyway, they take it and convert it to 380, which was, of course, a cartridge that never existed back then. But it is a really good cartridge for these conversions, simply because it's very low pressure. And, you know, they can kind of make it. They kind of, when they do the conversion cylinder, they kind of put the step in there so it goes in, head spaces, and it's going to get hit by the hammer and go off. And, you know, the danger with some of these are when you chamber them in 38 Special is that there is 38 Special Plus P out there, which these guns are never designed, were never even conceived would be a powerful cartridge that would be fired in these guns. So, you know, something like 380, which really doesn't have any plus P or plus P plus loadings, you know, the standard ammunition is going to work in it just fine. 38 Smith & Wesson, you know, the kind of chubby little 38 cartridge, not interchangeable with 38 Special, but the 38 Smith & Wesson was the same thing. You know, it really couldn't get into much trouble with that because there's really only one factory loading. It's pretty mild, and it worked pretty well. The nice part about that is it also had a rim, so it looked a little more authentic Old West. And actually, I think it came from like the late 1870s, early 1880s. So it's, you know, not a bad, not an exact fit, but not a horrible fit either. So my only problem with these, they kind of bring these things in, they photograph them beautifully, they hype them and everything, but there's really no extraction. There's no ejector rod on it. So guess what? That leaves you to having to take your fingernails and pick out the cartridges, or keep a little dowel or a little rod with you to bump these things out. I don't really care for that. I mean, you know, if you're paying $500, $600, $700 for something, I know they're trying to make it look Old Westy, but an ejector rod on there would probably be very, very helpful, and most people would welcome that. The other thing they had in there, which I thought was very interesting, was, you know, the Doug Turnbull restorations. He can take guns that look like they're, you know, pretty much had it, and he can turn them back into really better than factory new. You know, and the craftsmanship is incredible and all this. I don't really care for them. I kind of like patina on. I like the honest wear on older guns. Now, damage is another thing, and repairing damage is very legitimate. But I really like the patina on the older guns. His guns just look too good, to be honest with you. And the other side of the coin is for just an average Joe like me, you know, even if I did save up for a lot of years, whatever it would take to make one of those, and have it, I would never use it as a field gun. It would be a safe queen, very special, go to range on special occasions. You know, you spend that kind of money, and to me, I would put a scratch on it, and it's bad. It's very, very bad. So his are almost too good. I mean, they're almost too good. It would be nice, and I suppose there are people who are out there who are wealthy enough and affluent enough that, you know, it doesn't matter to them. Hey, they get it. That's the kind of gun they buy. You know, they don't buy the lower end stuff. They buy that and they use it, and, you know, that's the way it goes. But it was a very interesting magazine other than that. And of course they're selling advertising for the very expensive holsters and all that, and really right now that's, you can put a lot of money into holsters. You could put $500 to $1,000 into holsters. I mean, that is a big business, and that is a big deal. And of course they're absolutely beautiful works of art. I mean, it just, the way they photograph, and having seen some in person, Chisholm Trail is a very, very famous one that I've seen their work up hand close, talk to the people who make it, and they're fantastic, and they do a great job. But boy, you know, be prepared to lay out some cash, because it will cost you. Okay, this next thing is probably going to rankle some feathers, but I call it the CMP debacle. The CMP 1911 debacle. As you all know, in 1984, the U.S. military basically decided to replace its existing stock of 1911 A1 pistols with the Beretta 92F, and it later became the Beretta 92FS, but it was the Beretta 92F that they adopted. And this came after probably a decade of hemming and hawing about, do we need to replace them, do we not, how are we going to replace them, what does the new caliber need to be? All kinds of stuff went into that decision. The short story was, they held some all kinds of experiments and trials, and decided that the kind of the ideal pistol, in many ways, not always, but many ways, would be the CZ-75, the original. Well, back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, they were still a communist country, so strike one right there. And strike two and three were the fact that it did not have a hammer drop safety, and you had to ease, if you were going to carry a loaded round in the chamber, you had to pull the trigger to ease the hammer down, something that U.S. military is never going to go for that. So while it had a lot of great attributes, it came up short, had three strikes against it. We were never going to adopt a communist design weapon. Just was never going to happen. Just not going to happen. And how do you license that? How do you figure all that? Do you even bother to license it? I mean, so anyway, all of that was all of that. And the Beretta 92F was an excellent sidearm. You know, it had all the attributes, very safe, high quality of manufacture, all that stuff is good. So the 1911 started to retreat into history. And, you know, it didn't happen as fast as these people think, especially when you talk about the gamers and all this. They go, well, after 1984, you know, it was all the Beretta. No, it was not. I turned in 1911s in 1995. So, you know, and through the, I'm sure that was the same through the National Guard system and Reserve system. You know, it took a while to replace the 1911. 1911s went to the Gulf War. Not a lot of them. But some of them did. And, you know, it was kind of the secondary handgun for that conflict. But some did go. If you look at the numbers, and this is a slightly different tact, but I'll talk about this a little bit later. But I'll talk about the CMP right now. CMP got the permission to dispose of the surplus 1911s. They're now three generations old. The Beretta came in. Now the Beretta is being replaced by the new SIG M17 9mm. So, you know, the 1911s are looking even more dated, aged, and everything else. And it costs the government, I think, $2 or $3 a pistol to store them every year. And they had 100,000 pistols, so that's $200,000 to $300,000 that they're spending that they don't want to spend. So what they're doing is they're giving shipments to the CMP. I don't know how many. I don't know. They don't seem to publish it. But anyway, what happened is, I know they thought they were going to get 10,000 pistols a year for 10 years. Well, the first shipment they got was 8,000 pistols. And of those, a small percentage, probably 50 or 60 of them, turned out to be unsaleable. I assume that means cracked frames that could not and that they would not repair. So, you know, when you take the cracked frames, then those guns just become, they're completely unserviceable, unusable, so they just become parts guns for everything else. And that's not a lot of parts for 8,000 pistols, but it's some, you know, it's some. So what would happen is you would fill out a packet, send it in, and there's a very tight time window that you could send it in, and you had to have certain qualifications. Mine was easy because I was former military, so, you know, I didn't have to have the club participation memo and some of this other junk that other people were saddled with. But anyway, to make a long story short, I think they got 18,000 packets in, and they only had less than 8,000 pistols to sell. So, consequently, you know, everybody was given a number. They had a random number generator just basically your packet got a random number. Mine got it in like the mid-10,000s. So, and this was at the end of, I think I got my number in February or March, whatever it was, of 2019, you know, it was there, you know, so what? It was never going, I looked at it and said, man, these guys are going to sell out. They're never, until the next shipment comes in, I'm done. And they'd said, hey, you know, once you're on this list, you're on the list. And, you know, if we run out of pistols, well, we get another shipment in, then we pick up that list again. It's not like you had to start over again. So, figure, eh, I'll just sit on the list. Whatever happens, happens. And so I'd actually sort of put it on the farthest back burner you can imagine, to the point where I wasn't even thinking about it. Every once in a while I'd go, yeah, wonder how that ever turned out. My assumption was they sold out before they ever got close to my number. And so I'd have to wait for another shipment, whenever that was. So anyway, all of a sudden, out of the blue, I get a call. And it's, oh, this is so-and-so from the CMP 1911 program. You've been selected to purchase a pistol through our program. And I'm like, whoa, okay. You know, and here's the deal. You have 5 days. When they notify you with a phone call and with an email, you have 5 days to respond and pay. You don't have the cash. There's no layaway. There's no, I'll pay you next week. I'll happily pay you next week for a hamburger today. No, there's nothing. You have the credit card or the cash, and it's the credit card. Your credit or debit card, and you pay right then and there, and they ship you a pistol to your dealer, no matter what you have. If you have a CNR or whatever, that's no good. They ship it to a dealer who does another background check. So they have two background checks, one when you send your packet in, and then another one when you actually transfer the firearm from the dealer to you. So anyway, I was amazed, and so I said, well, what type do you have? And they go, well, we have service grade, field grade, and rack grade available, which I was surprised. I thought, even if I did get a call, I figure, well, they're probably just going to have the lower grades available. They'll sell out of the other ones. But no, they had them. My suspicion is that the tight time frame, that even though they have 18,000 packets, there's some sort of attrition rate there that probably maybe a third of the people who get a call say, hey, sorry, I can't afford it, I'm dropping out, or maybe some of these circumstances have changed. You know, people sadly die, so hey, you know, when they call for Joe Jones and they find out Joe passed away 6 months ago, well, I guess he's out of the pool. You know, that's it. That packet's gone. Other things are, you know, clearly you got to have the money, you got to be able to do this, you got to be able to execute all that, and some of that happens. Or some people just decide, hey, forget it, I'm done. You know, I'm not going to wait, I'm done. So anyway, there are enough obvious dropouts. For several reasons, that I actually got in. So I ordered a service grade, and you know, it's a K. It's a lot of money. That is a lot of money. It's a K. So there you go. So I did it, and the whole thing went off without a hitch. And let me tell you something, CMP is awesome. They are freaking awesome. They comply with the law. They send you quickly what you need, you know, what you've paid for. They know how to do the arrangement through. They were very, very accommodating and very excellent people to deal with. So when I say CMP debacle, it's kind of a larger context. It has nothing to do with the CMP organization itself. So anyway, that all happens. And then literally the same day I paid, over the phone, they shipped it overnight. And so literally I got it the next day. So I went down to my dealer, we did the transfer, and I live in a place where there's no waiting period or anything. You can do the transfer, and like I said, it's the second background check and everything that's been done on me vis-a-vis this particular pistol. So it all went very, very smooth, and literally I was out the door 24 hours later. I literally had this in my hand, you know. So that was very cool. That was very, very cool. Couple of things to note. Every picture I'd seen of a CMP shipped 1911 had come with a very nice kind of a little Pelican looking case that said CMP on it, and pretty nice. Well, I didn't get that. I got just a black cheapo, El Cheapo plastic case, actually a little too big for the gun. Obviously something they bought off the shelf for a very attractive price. I don't care. I didn't. The little Pelican case would have been nice, but who cares? Pelican style case. I'm sure it was some knockoff. But anyway, so it doesn't say that. I was very, very impressed with the documentation and everything that came with the pistol. Very, very nice. And the CMP sold exactly what they advertised. Actually, a little bit better. Their description of service grade, this pistol exceeds. It really exceeds it. And I mean, I have absolutely no complaint. They sold exactly what they advertised. Now, for me, you know, and there are some real... To leave the pistol I bought for a moment, there have been some real turds who've dealt with the CMP. And these guys put in a packet for themselves. They put in for one for their wives who don't really want one, but it's another chance to get one. They put it in for their fathers, their mothers, their brother-in-law, whatever family relative. And then they get that person to go and execute the purchase. And so one guy can wind up with four or five of these things. They've been doing that to the CMP for a long time. I knew a guy who did that with you know, M1 rifles, M1Ds, and 1903 A4s. And so, you know, I thought the guy was a jerk, and I still do. You know, I'm just like, yeah, okay, great. You've got four of them now, and there's three other collectors that can't even have one because you're hogging this. And there's no way the CMP can really know that or determine it. So these people get over, and if they got the cash to buy it, they got the cash to buy it. But unfortunately, other collectors wind up on the, or other people who want them, not necessarily collectors, but other people who want them, you know, wind up with zero because somebody has hogged them. And there's no way the CMP can really do that. CMP is not part of the government. Now, the old DCM was, and they had pretty stringent rules about what you could do and what you couldn't do, and you they had the kind of the weight of the government behind it. CMP does not. It's a private corporation designed to disperse surplus stuff that they're authorized to sell. So they're a private company. So all they can do is ban somebody from ever buying from them again. And I don't know if they've ever done that, but enough of these pistols have been flipped. You know, a guy buys three pistols. He keeps through his close relatives, because you're only allowed to buy one per lifetime. Like, I've bought one. There's no more for me. There's no more. Unless they change the rules, there is no more. And some of the better quality pistols they have, you can participate in the auctions and buy real collector pistols. You know, like if they come out with a 1911 that's got the original slide, original this, that, and the other thing. Well, they're not going to just ship it out as a service grade. They're going to put that on their auction site, and you can if you have not bought a pistol, that can be the pistol you buy is the one off the auction site. So, be that as it may, you know, some of these guys buy three or four pistols. They keep the one they want, and they flip the rest. And they, with the proceeds they get from selling the rest, the profit or the margin, they pay for their first pistol. That's a shitty thing to do, and those are shitty people. The other kind of people who are just annoying, they're not really bad people, they're just annoying. There are people who buy from the CMP who believe that somehow, since they're buying from the CMP, and before that it was the DCM, that they deserve to get a new condition, never been fired, never been issued firearm. And if they don't get that, they get mad. They get really mad. And it's like, dude, these have all been issued. These have all been, this current crop of these pistols. Now, I can't speak for way back in the day. I knew in the late 50s, they sold, you know, surplus 1911s. I assume those were probably pretty much whole guns, the way they were manufactured. They produced so many of them, they sold some, you know. Hadn't gone through the rebuild process and everything else. The ones that the CMP is selling now have all been through the rebuild process. So you wind up like me. I have an Ithaca frame and a Colt replacement slide. I mean, it looks nice, great gun, but it is not an original World War II gun. And the replacement slide has got a number on it, stamped on the right side. It's a 7709314, something like that. And it's, the slide has been refinished at least once, maybe even twice, and you can barely read that number. And on the other side, it said Colt's firearm patent, da da da. So, you know, it's an excellent slide because it's hardened. It's excellent 1950s, maybe early 1960s Colt production that has just been parkerized and then put on this other pistol. And so I got, it's really got a lot of the, it's got probably 99% plus of the parkerized finish on it. The finish does have some scuffs, not where it goes through to bare metal, but the parkerization has been scuffed a little bit. It's just the way it goes, handling marks, not a big deal. You know, so it's a very, very nice, very, very functional gun. My only disappointment is it appears that the front sight may have been worn down a little bit. Don't know for sure. Don't know where it shoots yet. So it may be a non-problem. May just be my non-calibrated eyeballs. I would expect it to be a little bit taller, but if it's not, it can be replaced. There are plenty of GI, you know, narrow tenon front sights out there. It takes the post-1943 style. Boom, there you go. So, you know, you get exactly what they advertise, and you pay the price that they have there, and, you know, that's what it is. The lower grades, I understand, can have some more corrosion and wear, and, you know, the lowest grade, the rack grade, can even have commercial replacement parts. You know, if the barrel bushing's bad, and they don't have a GI one to put in there, well, they'll put a commercial one in there. It looks the same, functions the same, but it's not a U.S. government part. It's a part they've sourced from somewhere else. And they're probably small parts. They do that too, you know. I can imagine slide stops and a few other things are probably that way. Do they swap parts around? I would assume that they do. And here's why I would say that is, obviously, if you've got a very nice Ithaca frame and a very nice Ithaca slide on another pistol, it kind of makes sense to match those two up, and then you can probably sell that on your auction site. Or if you have two pistols that you look at them and say, well, they're both going to be rack grade because one has a lot of wear, almost no finish left on the lower receiver, and the other one's got similar wear on the slide, but the lower receiver's in nice shape. You can put the nice slide on the nice receiver, and that way you have one rack grade gun and a service grade gun. So I would not be surprised if they've changed those around a little bit. They have also test fired the guns as near as I can determine. There was a little bit of carbon in there. Not much, because it looks like it may have only been fired once or twice. And, you know, I haven't seen their protocol. I don't know that they do that, but it looked to me like it had been fired like twice. So they got it. What are my overall impressions? First of all, I would say that we're extremely lucky that the CMP is actually able to sell anything at all. And I kind of look at it, I've saved this pistol from the eventual cruncher, where as soon as we got a Democratic president, it's going to go. So it's saved from that, fortunately. The other portion of this that is really good is that CMP just does such a great job. You know, their sales, you know, it was so smooth and easy to deal with. I was like dealing with, you know, some of these commercial guys that sell all the time. I've had great luck with Classic Arms, and you know, it was as easy to deal with them as it was, even though they have more requirements, just because the CMP is the CMP, and it's got some additional legal requirements that they have to comply with. My thoughts on the pistol are as such. I'm exceptionally pleased. To be able to own a pistol that was on active duty the same time I was is magical. Now, I was never issued this particular pistol. I don't know anything of its history other than when it was in the Army, I was in the Army. So I really like that. That's a lot of fun. That's something my World War II guns, you know, kind of don't have. They were kind of passed out of service and gone when I was in. So, you know, that's really kind of magical to me. I kind of like that. Just from a strict financial business thing, even the service grade gun I got, you know, I think was overpriced. I paid more for it than I would have had I been at the Tulsa Gun Show. You know, I would have paid less money for it. If I went to a large gun show and it was on the table, I would have offered less money. And, you know, I would have paid less. If they said, no, we're not going to budge, I probably would have walked. The fact that I'm the first civilian owner of this gun, because I don't count the CMP is just a transfer mechanism. Since I'm the first civilian owner and it was on active duty as I was, I'm very pleased with it. And I'm happy I got it. But just from a dollars and cents thing, yeah, it's probably about $200 overpriced. That's just the way it is, way it goes. So, you know, you can make your own value and your own judgment. You know, the other, I was talking about the second, there's also another kind of CMP guy that I can't stand, CMP customer. And that's the guys, and you see it, and I've run into guys like this, and I've actually got proof that one guy did this. They sit there and go, oh man, I got my gun from the CMP, and wow, they post pictures of it on social media or forums or something, and they're showing a gun that did not come from the CMP, a gun that was probably an earlier DCM gun. It's completely matching, completely never been rebuilt, doesn't have any of the attributes of it, and everybody's like, oh wow, you're so lucky, or the worst ones is, I'm so lucky I got this. Dude, you know, you're shining us, because you've taken your CMP gun out of its Pelican case and you put this other collector gun in there that you probably owned for 20 years. I've got a Remington Rand that's in great shape from World War II, and I could have easily have done that. And it's all original, completely good, and very little finish wear. And I could have said, oh, that's my service grade. You know, it's just people do that. I don't know why people do that, but they do. There are guys who have claimed to have gotten, you know, intact original 1911s, you know, made 1918 out of it. And I'm just sitting there going, no, I don't think you do, because they would have put that on their auction site. Because they know exactly what they have. They know exactly where the lower receiver, the receiver comes from, where the slide comes from. You know, they're not fools. There's a little tag on the gun, on mine, that says Ithaca receiver and Colt replacement slide. It's just there. You know, there's no two ways about that. So, anyway, I'm extremely pleased. I hope that they're able to continue. I hope it's one of the things they don't have to secure any more permission from Congress, that shipments of pistols just kind of keep showing up there, and that they're able to distribute the last 100,000 of the 1911s, one of the greatest sidearms of all time. So that's my experience. I'm exceptionally happy, and I'm sure that I'm going to get some great use out of this gun. That's the part I really like about it, is it's not so collectible that I can't use it. I know I can take it out and fire it. And I know it's got the improved parts on it with the slide and a few other things that are just going to make it a very, very fun gun to own and shoot. So that's the CMP deal right there. And, they're well worth supporting. And if they open up the packets again, and you would never put one in, put one in, because the worst thing that can happen is they call you up and you say, hey, sorry, forget it. I don't really want to do it. And, you really haven't lost anything. So that's my impressions and take on the CMP 1911. Okay, it's a little bit late in the cast, but this is my favorite part of the show, questions and answers. And a few of them have been stacking up. But the first one we have is, what are the best shooter gifts for Christmas? And, it depends. If somebody's got a specific request, that's always the best gift. But if you've got a shooter on your Christmas list and you don't know what to get them, to my mind, you want to surprise them. You don't want to say, hey, what do you want? And you get told what it is. If you really want to surprise somebody, get them good quality magazines for their favorite firearm. And if that's a 1911, go out and get the, Chip McCormick's are nice, Wilson's are nice, even if it's only one or two. It's a lot of times there's that thing of, I can buy cheap and get five of them. It's really better to get one or two and buy really good quality. So I think those are always great gifts. People appreciate it. Everybody wants really good magazines, because in good guns, almost all of your malfunctions, that you're going to get are going to come from the magazine. So when you got really good quality magazines, they last a long time. They're great. And, they're a pleasure to use. It's like any other top-notch piece of equipment. And, face it, for, under 50 bucks, you can get really nice magazines. I mean, most of them are in the, for a 1911, say, are in the $30 to $40, $45 range. You can get any of the big name ones. And, that's good. Even if the guy's got a vintage gun, when you're out on the range, having a pad on the bottom isn't a bad thing. And if the person is a competitor, well, they can never have too many good quality magazines. So that's a great gift. And that's kind of where I would leave that. Okay, next one is, why do you think the M1911 is so great? Well, I guess the short answer is, because it is so great. That's why I think it's great, because it actually is. But to specify and quantify that a little bit, number one, I think it's absolutely an enlightened design. And it really, almost every modern pistol is a derivative of the 1911. They call it the parallel ruler geometry, but the basic geometry of the gun, the layout of the gun, has been copied by everybody, even Glock. You know, the trigger system might be different, the materials might be different, but essentially everything is kind of at least a descendant, if not a copy, if not a clone, is a descendant of the 1911. And you just can't dispute that. I mean, there's a reason why handguns don't look like broom handle Mausers anymore. There just is. The Lugers kind of went down a path, and there were a couple of Luger-like guns. You know, the Laty kind of comes to mind. But, you know, that kind of went as a dead end, too. Just a very tangent. And, a few countries used the Luger and liked it. And, you know, there's still some around. Not in service, but, you know, you can get the Swiss Lugers and things. But, you know, everything really looks like it came from a 1911. When you put a 1911 against every other pistol, including modern pistols, you can definitely just see the lineage. If you say this came first and this came later, you can see where they took some of the design. Now, they do. There was a simplified link system used in the Browning High Power that is in there, but it's still, you know, fundamentally the same. They still kind of break down the same way. There's a slide stop. It usually pops out, and, you know, the slide comes off the frame and all this. They're fundamentally all descendants of the 1911. Now, does that make the 1911 the penultimate design or the ultimate design? And, you know, you have to say no, but it has so many good attributes that you can't really discount it, even though that it's almost 2020, and 108 or 109 year old design. And actually, it's older. The design is a little older than that. But, you know, it was adopted 1911, so it was adopted 109 years ago. Unfortunately for us, a lot of the excellence of the 1911 is really captured in anecdotal stories and not in hard data or repeatable data or data that can be manipulated. The 1911 was used with great effect in two world wars. And I can tell you, I don't really like to say this story, but I will. I can tell you that in the First World War, my grandmother's brother, Great Uncle Harry, was awarded a Distinguished Service Cross for pinning down and taking out a German machine gun nest so his men could maneuver around and finish the job. Okay? He did that with a 1911 pistol. A great pistol. I'm sure I don't know that he could have pulled that off with a 1917 revolver, because I don't think they would have loaded fast enough. But he was probably carrying, I'm assuming he was carrying probably one magazine in the pistol, in the 1911, and had at least two more in a magazine pouch. Maybe even had four more, I don't know. But he was able to neutralize this machine gun nest so that it wouldn't kill his men while they maneuvered around and eventually took it over and occupied it. So, you know, that is greatness. Could he have done the same thing with another pistol? Well, I don't know. I don't know that a Luger would have done the same thing. I'll tell you this right now. A Luger does not load as fast as a 1911, where last shot, the slide's locked back, you put in a new magazine, hit the slide stop, the slide goes forward, and you're back in business. You don't have to, you know, fool with the toggle on top of the gun. Even though the Luger locks back, I think it's just a little bit slower to me, anyway. Would a 9mm have performed as well as the 45 ACP? Well, you know, maybe not. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that says the 45 ACP is a very good man-stopper, especially when you're talking full metal jacket military ammunition, compared to other calibers. Now, the argument that, well, they've made all these great strides in 9mm ammo. Okay, well, that's great, but that's now. We're talking about back then. And we're also talking about that you have to have that ammo to use it. even today. And I would suggest that most people who carry a 9mm and who swear by it are shooting, at least for practice, scads of just FMJ ammo, which, you know, it's a real debate that that is inferior to 45 ACP full jacket ammo. So a lot of the 45 automatic lore and legend and myth and everything else is all in anecdotal stories and not really in hard fact data. So it's therefore impossible to, quote, argue. I personally believe in the 45 ACP. I also believe that it was exceptionally effective when somebody's crawling into your trench. A bad person, a bad guy is crawling into your trench or into your foxhole, and at very short distances, the 45 automatic is the weapon to have. In my opinion, it just is. It's the weapon to have. And I'm not alone in this. Even after the adoption of the Beretta 92 by the U.S. military, certain units that had the Latitude stuck with 1911s, and 1911s were, in fact, these 1911s had been, they were selected from the military pool of 1911s, and they were worked over by gunsmiths and modernized and accurized a little bit, and they were issued to some elite special operations units that operated in Iraq and Afghanistan. Sorry, that's just the truth. Now, that only happens because people believe in the 45 automatic. People believe in the 1911, its reliability, its durability, and its stopping power. So that's why I feel it's so great. I also feel that the last ones we bought were in 1945, and 50 years later, I was still turning them in, and they were entirely serviceable. And in fact, I fought an unsuccessful battle to keep them. The problem was we had started our engagement in the Balkans and a peace enforcement effort. And so we had Haiti, then the Balkans. And so what happened was there was a greater need for pistols on these operations. So they would strip units that were staying in the United States, say, rather than buy more pistols, they would just say, give us your pistols. So you wouldn't have them. You would hand loan them to these other units that were going overseas. So therefore, you didn't have them, couldn't train with them, didn't have them. You had an empty rack where you would have normally had your M9 pistols. So my viewpoint was, let's keep the 1911s because we had all the magazines, we had all the good stuff for them, we had it all, and why don't we keep those and train with those because we can teach the fundamentals of pistol marksmanship with the 1911, and then we can transition back to our M9s when they're finally returned to us. And of course that was vetoed because everybody wanted to get rid of the 1911s because everybody wanted the new thing. But I think that would have been a much better answer. And but now those same 1911s, the ones like we turned in, are now, you know, coming out through the CMPs. So the 1911 was just a great pistol, and it still has relevance. There are still the number of militaries that still use 1911 pistols is amazing. If Wikipedia is to be believed, and it's probably good. Now some of these nations that they list as current users are really, you know, only certain parts. Maybe the police use it, or maybe they're some special part of their force uses it, but essentially, a lot of militaries still use the 1911 pistol. It's just that good, and they last. They're durable. A lot of the people who talk about, well, you know, I had one in Vietnam, and the thing rattled and shook all over the place and all that. I've never run across one that actually behaved like that, because when you check the pistol, to check the pistol if it's good, you have to do it with the hammer down, okay? And shake the pistol, and you probably won't, and take the magazine out because the magazine will bounce around in there, but you shouldn't feel the pistol shaking on the slide very much at all. The next one is push down on the barrel hood, and there shouldn't be a lot of play on the barrel hood. It should be solid there, and if that's happening, you've got a good pistol. The other place to check is the barrel bushing. You know, if the barrel bushing is reasonably, doesn't have to be insanely tight, but if it's reasonably tight, that pistol is going to shoot very, very well. But that being said, I never really looked at the 1911 as being this great long-range weapon. That, to me, was, that's the weapon that's going to save your life up close. I'd rather have it than a knife. You know, I'd rather be confronting someone. If somebody jumps into my trench, my foxhole, or, you know, comes around a tree, I've got that in my hand. I know I can put a couple of rounds right in them, and it's going to be over. It's going to be over right there. So even in this day of body armor, you know, it's still, you know, you hit somebody where they don't have body armor, they're going to know it. So I believe in the 1911, and I believe in the 45 ACP cartridge. I think 1911s and other calibers, there are 40 caliber, the 10 millimeter, there's our 10 millimeter, 9 millimeter, and 38 super. I think that about rounds it. And of course, there's some 22 caliber ones, service aces and things like that. But in 45 caliber, it is really two great ideas coming together. The other reason I think it's great is simply because it feels excellent in the hand. It doesn't need interchangeable back straps. It doesn't need the rest of that kind of junk. I'm very happy with it. A lot of people went to the flat mainspring housing. They thought that was actually better than the arched one. I think they're completely wrong. I think the arched mainspring housing is much better. And it feels really good in the hand. Fits the hand. There's certain places where your hand is a little bulgy around the thumb. And that area, the bottom of your thumb towards the center of your hand by the wrist. And the pistol fits in very, very well there. The other thing I like about it is I like the grip safety. To me, the grip safety adds a lot of... It's a great little safety. I've never had the gun not go off because the grip safety was not disengaged. You know, some people, you know, they had to take, you know, skateboard tape and tape that and all the rest of it. I've never had a problem with it. And I've shot it in competition enough that I don't feel that it's a real problem to use. So I actually kind of look at the grip safety as the equivalent, it's the 1911 equivalent of the trigger safety you find on modern guns like the Safe Action pistols, you know, the Glock, the Smith & Wesson, and it goes on and on. The ones that have the little safety tab on the trigger that has to be depressed before the trigger goes. Well, the absolute inverse of that is the grip safety. It's just on the opposite side of the gun, and it's the same deal. It's functionally, the idea is the same. This little deal has to be depressed for the gun to operate and work. If it doesn't, it's still in a safe condition where it's not going to fire. So, you know, I think it's actually a good little thing. I've never had a problem with the grip safety on an M1911, but it is a very rare attribute in modern pistols. You don't find grip safeties and things anymore, but, you know, it is what it is. So I think that the 1911 is an absolute great pistol, and I like having a pistol that people who have gone before me have used effectively. It's, you know, it is just like the M250 caliber. You know, it is such a great weapon that, you know, just the thought of replacing it just makes people cringe because it's reliable, accurate, and robust. And that's what people really want in weapons. Weapons that are loved are that way. And that's the final attribute. Everybody can complain about the weight, but they want something that's robust, reliable, and accurate that they can hit the enemy with. And that's kind of the litmus test that an infantryman will put against any weapon he's handed. And I know that InRange TV talks about how great the Chauche is, and it was really wonderful, and it kind of got a bum rap. But the Chauche was a piece of junk. It was trash. And the fact of the matter is, it wasn't bad for a first effort, I suppose, but it came up sorely wanting because it did not pass the accuracy, durability, or reliability conditions that infantrymen demand of their weapons. You demand it. And weapons that do that, even if they're not the most efficient, are weapons that people have a lot of trust and confidence in. So that's why I think the 1911 is great. I've always thought it's great. I've always thought that It's a privilege to have a gun that good to use. It really is. And it's the most versatile gun going. You can have it from the bare-bones service configuration, like the CMP guns. Or you can, you know, I've got one that's got target sights on it and has been accurized and has got a very good trigger and everything else. And that gun is a pleasure and deadly accurate to shoot. So it's a gun that can be used to do a lot of different things. You know, whatever your needs are, you can tailor your 1911 to kind of fulfill those needs. Now, for the people who think they're shit and garbage, they're always going to think that. And they don't believe in the 45 ACP. And, you know, that's all fine. One of the things I like to tell them, though, is that when they think their Glock or whatever else is so hot, it's like, remember, 45 ACP 1911 pistols went through incredible training, and they fired thousands of rounds without a failure, just like the modern guns do. So, you know, is there a big difference there? And I'm not sure there is. And I think that's one of the reasons. It's more than nostalgia that keeps the 1911 one of the best-selling type of pistols today, made by any number of a dozen, any manufacturer that's got the capacity to make it, even SIG and Dan Wesson. Smith & Wesson made a 1911. Ruger makes a 1911. All these people make 1911 pistols. That's more than nostalgia. You know, you can't turn your back on that. You can't turn your back on that. That's nostalgia. Springfield Armory has made, you know, decades. Kimber, all these guys have made, you know, decades worth of 1911 pattern pistols. And actually, some of the ones that are most loved are the basic GI. The more GI it looks, that may be driven by nostalgia. I give them that. But, you know, these guns are, everybody likes them. Everybody drives them. They still are in competition. Now, granted, they've had to create some special categories for them. But people like them, and people use them. And people find them very, very effective. So that's why I think the 1911 is great. And this is going on probably way too long, but I just want to say that, you know, it's a pleasure to have that gun and to use it. Well, this brings to an end another edition of Old School Guns. Remember, we are on Podbean, and we are also on, I guess we're also on YouTube too, because I hit that icon, and we go onto YouTube. But nobody really looks for podcasts there. But they do on iTunes, so we're on iTunes also. Remember, you are always free to send me comments. You can leave them on the Podbean site. I think you can do it on iTunes also. You can leave some comments there if you want to send me anything or comment on anything I've said. That's definitely good. And if you have a question you would like me to answer, we can do that also. But for right now, this is the end of the 49th episode of Old School Guns. And this is Old School Guns out.